This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Earlier this month, we aired a show about how our communities should respond to increasing acts of hate across our nation. Connecticut is not immune. That show got a lot of response during and after the broadcast. One of the callers was a New Haven woman who stressed the importance of tolerance. She urged listeners to consider that violence and further hate speech to counter these incidents will do nothing to heal a nation divided. And while the presidential campaign drew attention to the divisions within our country, another caller told us to remember there's still a lot of good happening in our towns and cities. That sentiment drew us to this next story out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. It's a story of partnership between two different faith communities. Joining us now from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield is Reverend Sarah Smith, Senior Minister of the United Congregational Church in Bridgeport, and Mohammed Hamada, Community Board Member of the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. Reverend Smith and Mohammed, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Hi, Lucy. Nice to be with you today.
Well, I want to start first with Reverend Sarah. Can I call you Reverend Sarah?
That's what everybody calls me.
Tell us about your church. I understand it's had a very long history. But
we're older than God, yes. We came here. We're the original pilgrims. We're 321 years old. We started on Park Ave when it was called Division Street and Meeting House Hill. And we've moved around a bit. We were the WASP church in the 50s. And we have a big, grand, glorious Georgian revival church on the corner of Park and State with a steeple that is known, it's iconic in the city, as a beacon of hope. And we're getting ready to turn a page and start the next chapter of our wonderful history.
You mentioned it was a big church. So at one time, how big was the congregation and where does it stand now?
Well, like most churches, we have shrunk a bit, but the bubble of the 1950s was a bubble. Church was never big anywhere. And then we went through this post-World War II where that was a cultural thing to do. And we had 3,000 members back then, and they would all show up on Sunday decked out, you know. And so they needed a building to hold them. And we have a 22,000-square-foot building. It's glorious. It's magnificent. We love it. But we are 300 now, and we're strong, we're active, we're a vital congregation. But if we didn't do something, that building would kill us. And I just couldn't let that happen. I thought it was unethical and irresponsible as a spiritual leader to let my wonderful congregation that has so much going on, we got old people, young people, babies, everything in between, to let that pass into another history book rather than say, okay, let's have the courage to figure something out for a new chapter.
And when did you begin that process? I assume you had to get your congregation on board.
Well, we've been planting seeds because I knew it was going to have to happen eventually. They knew when I went to the elders of the church with this plan that just sort of landed in our laps in October with the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. The elders of the church, we call them life deacons, they said, oh, we've been talking about this for 20 years. We knew it was just a matter of time. And we've been living half of our budget out of what we call our endowment, which was a gift from our ancestors. But you're not supposed to live on it. You're supposed to just use the earnings of it. And we've been using the principal. And our investors came and said, you know, you got 3 years if you keep going like you're going. And so all the seeds that we planted, I started watering them a lot. And I think because we knew it was coming, but we also had a plan, and we had planted a seed, and then they just sprouted. And every time, as through this process, every time we needed a lifeboat, God sent a lifeboat. And that's what Bridgeport Islamic Community Center is to us, but then also to our outreach corporation that feeds thousands of people every week. This arrangement also saves it. So we're good.
You're mentioning this arrangement. I wanted to bring Mohammed into the conversation. You're a community board member of the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. So the UCC in Bridgeport needed to find something to do with this building. It was becoming too costly for them to run, given the size now of their congregation. They wanted to sell it. When did the Islamic Center decide to come forward and say that, you know, this might be a place for us?
Well, let me just give you a little bit of background, right? So the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center was established back in 2000 with a vision to have a place where community members can do more than just praying. They need to do other activities. A large portion of that is teaching our young kids what some people may call moderate Islam, but we call it true Islam because Islam is moderate in nature. So we had a small building on Clinton Avenue in Bridgeport, but it became too small for us to have all of our community members there. So we started looking for a bigger place. We've been looking for about 2 or 3 years now for another place. And, you know, being partners with the United Congregational Church, we know them very well. They know us very well. So they knew about our search. And when it became time for them to, what's the word here, Reverend? Sorry, well, downsize?
We were downsizing. That's exactly what we are. I mean, if a family came to me in financial crisis and said, we have this big house, but our more, you know, it costs this much, I'd say get a smaller house.
Exactly,
and so
yes.
That's what they did. And we've known BIC for years. And we through the Tent of Abraham, our interfaith work, and our church has been a leader in that. Right. And we trust these people. We love these people. We're friends with these people. We've done sacred conversations on religion. We are a firm believer that there are many paths to God. And the main thing is you get on it and dig deep into it. And so it doesn't take away our Christian faith. It deepens it because then we stand next to someone who their faith means something. And BIC had talked to us last spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, we're not quite ready. So when everything happened in September, I emailed one of them and I said, are you still interested? And they came back. Yes.
Yeah, and we were honored that we were the first people they approached, and possibly, and you can confirm that, Trevor and Sarah, the only people they approached. So it was a great honor for us to be considered as the next, you know, owners of that beautiful building.
Well, and this one day, Lucy, they came in and they looked at our sanctuary or the masjid that they will have as a place of prayer. And see, on the outside of our building is a wonderful quote from the Jewish scriptures, from Isaiah, and it says, this house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. Now, I doubt the Congregationalists back in 1924 when we built this building, which is our sixth building, I doubt they thought it was going to be Muslims would be praying in there, but we are living out that prophet. We're living out that beautiful words of wisdom. And the thing where my light went off was when the BIC leaders said to me, this will always be a house of prayer and your people are always welcome.
This is where we live.
And we want the United Congregational Church to be active in the community because you do outreach better than ever. We want you to stay and do your outreach here. We're on the corner of Park and State in your building. But we'll have it as our center. But we want you to do our outreach. We'll learn from you and we'll partner with you. When they said that to me, I knew we could make it.
This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. That's Reverend Sarah Smith, a senior minister of the United Congregational Church in Bridgeport, and Muhammad Hamada, community board member of the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. They're joining the conversation today from the studios of WSHU down in Fairfield. We're talking with them because they have an interesting arrangement, a partnership. The UCC is selling their church. It's gotten too big for their congregation. To BIC, as Reverend Sarah Smith mentioned, that's Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. Now, both of you sound very passionate and you believe in that this is going to work, but there's got to be sentiment in the community at a time where we hear about divisions within faith communities, about the idea of a Christian church turning into a mosque. How do you approach that?
Well, I first remind them that we are cousins. We all come from the father of Abraham, our father, Abraham. And I think he'd be so pleased. We have been a fractured family, the Christians and Jews and Muslims. We've done enough killing in God's name. And it is time to show that we are kinfolk. And we might pray differently, but we pray to the same God. And we might look different. We might even sound different. We might dress different. But, you know, if you hold on to your faith, there's a great Buddhist saying, there are many wells to the one water. And whatever well you drink from it deeply. And when you drink from your faith deeply, then you can respect that someone else does too. And to me, we're continuing to be a beacon of hope on that corner, because we already had Jews involved in our outreach, and now we're going to have Muslims. And the children of Abraham are going to make world peace on the corner of Park and State, and of all places, Bridgeport, Connecticut.
That's a great point, Reverend Sarah. So we're all humans, right? We're all the sons of Adam and Eve. We may do things different, but, you know, at the end, we're pretty much the same. We're people. We get sad for the same things and happy for the same things. We care about our kids. We love our, you know, spouses. We're people. In terms of the sentiment, Lucy, my own belief is the Bridgeport or the greater Bridgeport community has done advanced work in the interfaith field, right? So we've been doing interfaith activities for many, 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 many years. When did the tent of
We've been doing
start?
Interfaith work for 50 years.
Okay,
this is not new.
For me personally, I the first interfaith event I joined was in 2009. But we do a good number of interfaith events every year. We have the Thanksgiving at the United Congregational Church.
Uh-huh. We
have a Ramadan breakfast, what we call iftar. Uh-huh.
And then we have interfaith Passover at the synagogue.
Passover. Mm-hmm. And we do other activities as well. We did the cleaning of the city.
We cleaned up a park.
All kinds of stuff.
So we
don't feel that sentiment.
It sounds like you guys are good at partnering, and we're going to hear more about how you're going to transform again this church into a mosque. After the break, this is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Again, I'm speaking with Reverend Smith, Senior Minister of the UCC in Bridgeport, and Mohammed Hamada, Community Board Member of the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. Now, how common are these sales from one faith community to another? And how does a building that once housed a Christian church get transformed into a mosque? We're going to find out after the break. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're talking to two Connecticut residents about a unique partnership in Bridgeport that will turn a Christian church into a mosque. The UCC church at the corner of State Street and Park Avenue will be sold to the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. And by May, the sale is expected to be completed. The building will be transformed into a mosque that serves 1,000 Muslim families. Joining us from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield, Reverend Sarah Smith, Senior Minister of the United Congregational Church in Bridgeport, and Mohammed Hamada, Community Board Member of the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. Mohammed, I wanted to ask you, talk about the process of transforming this church building once the sale is completed. You know, how will you do that?
So I think we were asked that question before. So not much. we just need to make few changes. So we will take the pews out, of course, and put a carpet in place. We may need to add more restrooms.
I thought we have 14. That's not enough. Good grief.
Yeah.
Well, and Lucy, they've been very respectful that Christians are going to take the Christian symbols, that they didn't want anybody to say the Muslims were de-churching the building. And so we'll take the cross off the steeple. And we're trying to take the crosses out of our – we have three beautiful stained glass windows, and we're trying to figure out how to do that and then replace them with glass that the BIC would like. And then because we're Congregationalists, our sanctuary is beautiful, but it's not adorned with a lot of Christian symbols. And so we're going to take some historic plaques off the wall and, you know, things like that, our baptismal font. And we're lining that up slowly but surely to take care of all those things. But, you know, the basement is going to be where all of our outreach through the not-for-profit I started, the Norma Freem Urban Outreach Initiatives, Inc. It's a 501c3 outreach corporation. And we had about eight 9 really good, strong programs. We have doubled that since BIC came into the picture. And we are just booming. And we'll be down in the basement. They're going to give us rent free so we can feed people together. And we're gonna keep feeding our neighbors, keep clothing them, keep educating, keep. We're the only emergency shelter in the city, and we're gonna keep doing that. We're already doing that along with the BIC programs that are coming in to help our neighbors. And so the it's gonna be a beehive. It will be much more than just a mosque, but it's Muhammad can speak more to that.
And just to add to that and give you some perspective. So when the United Congregational Church board indicated that after the sale, they would like to continue their outreach program, the decision from the board of directors of the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center was unanimous. It came back with one word: absolutely. This is what we do. This is a major part of our Islamic teachings, to care for the less fortunate people, to be good to our neighbors. And just to give you a quick story, because there's a lot of misconceptions out there. So I would like to just give you a quick story about Prophet Muhammad. At his time, he had a neighbor who rejected Islam and didn't like his message, and used to throw garbage, or her garbage rather, in front of his house every day. And one day, Prophet Muhammad came out, and there was no garbage. So he asked, well, what happened? And people told him that that lady is sick that day. He went to visit her to make sure she's well. So it's our duty to be good to our neighbors, and everybody in Bridgeport is our neighbor, and make sure that we help those who are in need. So I thank you, Reverend Sarah, for all the work you've done. And we are very excited to join you in it, because this is what we want to do.
And so it's going to be a buzz down there. And we, but you know, I think somebody asked me, are you going to unconsecrate the sanctuary? I'm like, absolutely not. This is a holy place, no matter who prays in it. And we're going to make it holy, because we also, all Jews, Christians, Muslims on that corner, are going to live out what our faith tells us is to care for the poor, to feed the hungry, to shelter the homeless. Yeah. And we're going to do it even bigger and better than we've ever done it, and we're going to do it together.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Again, we're talking about an interesting partnership happening in Bridgeport, Connecticut, between the UCC Bridgeport and the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center. I wanted to turn back to you, Muhammad. You said that not much will change. Obviously, the Christian crucifixes, the baptismal font will be removed by the UCC. But when you look at – this is not like this is the only time this transaction has happened. We've heard about churches closing around our country and also around other communities around the world. Do you look to how the process happened in other communities to how it would work for you in Bridgeport, Connecticut?
Well, every community is unique, right? So we do what we think is right for us. I haven't been involved in how other communities transformed their buildings. But for us, you know, we don't see much change. And we discuss that on a regular basis in our board meetings. Again, very minor changes are needed to the building. It's a beautiful building. I wish you can come down, Lucy, and see it one time, even before the sale. The building is very good as it is. We're just going to make some adjustments to the way we pray. That's all.
They're going to face a different direction, because they face Mecca. So, and I won't get to preach. That's the big thing. But I want to make sure people know the United Congregational Church is not dying. We started Bridgeport. We were the first thing in Bridgeport 321 years ago. We're making another 321 years of history. We're going to go down the street and lease a space from the Bessemer Center. It's the center of one of our sister United Church of Christ. That's what denomination we are. It's one of our sister churches in that denomination. And then we're going to get our sea legs, get grounded. And we're strong, we're active, we're vital, we're loving, we're together. This process has actually pulled us closer. And we're going to go down to Bessemer Center, do our churchy things, and then eventually we'll find the next building, the seventh building for United Congregational Church. And we're going to keep doing our outreach, though, at the corner of Park and State with our good friends of BIC. And so our not-for-profit wins, our neighbors win, BIC wins, United Congregational Church wins. This had God all over it. And because we listened and we had courage, and we defied what people said we could do. We went against stereotypes. We went against hatred. We said, no, on this corner, we live differently. Mm-hmm. We believe differently. We have respect and dignity. And we, it's not just tolerance. It's beyond tolerance. It's acceptance. It's respect. It is love. It's being a friend. And we're going to do all that together. And so now on our board of our outreach, we have intentionally now not just to have random a Jewish person or a Muslim person, Christian person. We are going to intentionally put that. So not only are we having BIC be volunteers and our and the person that we that runs our building, and I'll run all the outreach programs, but we're going to have it from the governance on down.
Reverend Smith, if I could ask you, what kind of negative feedback have you received?
Oh, a little here or there, you know, but not much because and also I don't play into it. I so firmly believe that this is where we need to go and how we need to do it, and that this is a blessing for everyone. And I am not threatened by BIC. I know who I am. I know what I believe, and I respect what they believe. I used to teach world religions at a university in Buffalo, New York, when I was a minister back there, and I've worked at interfaith my whole ministry career after I was a lawyer, and it is makes my faith richer. It takes nothing away. And then also, we can be a beacon of peace, and we need that in our world. We've got to quit killing each other in God's name. And we kill physically, but we also kill each other's souls. And so we haven't gotten much, a little bit, but I just don't pay much attention to it. I go right on, and we are going to show, not just tell, we're going to show how we can live in peace.
And Mohammed, I'd like to ask you that same question. Mm-hmm. What kind of negative feedback has BIC received?
We haven't gotten any negative feedback, but you have to assume that there are some people who are not happy with this, right? I mean, right. You don't have to be genius to figure that out, right? But the only way we can deal with this is to face hate with love, ignorance with knowledge, mm-hmm. and intolerance with empathy. And, you know, I salute Reverend Sarah and her congregation for doing what they did from a strength, position, right? As she said, this does not weaken the United Congregational Church. People should have more respect for what they did. It takes a lot of courage and wisdom to do that. Would they have been better to wait 5 more years, burn all the cash they have, and then close it and shut it down and let the city take over the building and it becomes an abandoned building and people break into it? I mean, was that a better choice? No. So it shows wisdom and courage.
thank you.
And I do salute you for
that.
Oh,
well, thank you.
But One thing to say here about the negative sentiment out there, and we cannot ignore it or hide from it. I mean, you know, after all the vicious events that happened in the past years, since 9/11 or even before, Muslims were faced with two choices: either hide and go into a shell, or come out and show themselves and show what true Islam is. And that's why Muslim communities across America, not just here in Bridgeport, across the whole country, became very, very active in interfaith event. When we talk to somebody in California, do you guys have interfaith event? Again, absolutely yes. Even in Connecticut here, the Interfaith Council of Southwest Connecticut, its president is Dr. Kareem Adib, who's a Muslim, and that Council has a number of churches and synagogues. Mm-hmm. So Muslims had to be active in interfaith activities to show who they are. And that's the only way we can deal with that negative sentiment you're referring to, Lucy. We have to bridge the knowledge gap. We have to educate people. And I ask your listeners, if you have any misconceptions about Islam, if you have mistrust, negative views, come learn about Islam from us. Come mm-hmm. visit us. Ask mm-hmm. us what Islam means. Yeah. We'll let you know. Don't get your Islamic education from Sean Hannity or anybody else. Come learn from us. Learn about Muslims from Muslims.
Muhammad, I have said in sermons again and again on interfaith, and I think this is why my church was ready, because we've been trying to get well-versed in it. And I remember one day I said, if you don't know a Muslim, get to know one, because they're amazing people.
Ask us whatever question you have, and we're happy
Muhammad,
to answer.
Muhammad, yes. I would like to ask you to tell me about the families in your community that are growing. Where do they come from and their professions?
It's a very diverse community. So we have people from every country you can think of. We have people from Pakistan, Bangladesh, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, you name it, China, Indonesia, India. All countries in terms of professions.
And some that are from right here, right?
Homegrown. And some are right. From here, yeah. I mean, but everybody has roots somewhere,
sure.
Right? So in terms of professions, we have a good number of college professors at the Fairfield University, Sacred Heart University. We have Muslim professors here, University of Bridgeport. I myself work for, one of the Fortune 500 companies.
Oh, I need to get to know you better, okay?
And, it's a very highly educated community. All people who came from other countries looking for a better life, like everybody else, Lucy, mm-hmm. right? I mean, nobody left their country, whether it's Italy or Ireland, to come here to have, what they have. Everybody was looking for a better life and a better opportunity, and Muslims are no different. We're just looking for a peaceful, better life to live.
Lucy, when we sat down to negotiate the terms of our sale, I was with Mr. George Carter, who's chair of the People's Bank Board here in Bridgeport, and just a wonderful man. He's also chair of our trustees. And then another one of our trustees, Dr. Don Gibson, who's a dean of the business school at Fairfield U. And after this, it was like something I had never experienced. And the respect, and it was a holy event. And George, who doesn't talk about spiritual stuff very often, and he went home and he told his wife, he says, that was I've done business dealings my whole life, but that one was like none other I've ever done. The camaraderie, the respect, it wasn't who can get a better deal. It was, how do we take this? You need this, we need this, and make it work. We were problem solvers together. And it was... it was just really, we all felt it that night. Yes. We all had tears in our eyes that we were changing the world.
Mm. Yeah. And Lucy, I may have got myself in trouble here by not mentioning Brazil as one of the countries Muslims come from. So my wife just sent me a text. So.
Don't forget the Brazilians. Oh, my goodness. You just opened a can of worms.
So we just have a few more minutes, but I wanted to just ask you again, Reverend Smith, you mentioned when you mm-hmm. sat down to finalize this agreement mm-hmm. to transfer the UCC building to BIC, the Bridgeport Islamic Community mm-hmm. Center. What was any feedback from the city or historic preservationists? And I'm just curious, who was at the table?
Well, it was eight of the people of the BIC council, and then the three from our church. And we shook on it. We met twice. We only had to meet twice, and we came up with a sale price that we could all live with. We are doing owner financing, so we're sort of like the bank, and we're giving BIC a mortgage. Mm-hmm. And so we will continue to be in relationship for the next 7 years, and I hope after that. We worked out the purchase, but then we worked out a lease for our outreach corporation to remain in the building. And then we have to, of course, let the lawyers earn their money. So they're duking it out over all the details. But It was a gentle person's agreement around that table, and we are seeking to honor it, even with the lawyers. And but that, you know, we the historic the outside of the building will not change as far as the stuff that makes it a historic building, and inside it's not really going to change much either. And we will take our cross, we will take our altar, we will take our baptismal font. We're going to sell our pews. Two churches have already called. Somebody wants to buy our big Austin 6000 pipe organ. I mean, all these you know, the people are coming out of the woodwork to help us make it happen. And we're sharing the cost with BIC of fixing the stained glass. And so it's been a real partnership, and it's sad. Now, Lucy, I can't ignore, it's hard on my people. You know, you as you know, whether you're Christian or Muslim or Jew, you nest where you are. Even Buddhists nest. And so it's hard to lose this magnificent building where you've gotten married or baptized your children or buried someone you love or all the things that are matter in life. And but in our Christian faith, we're going to go through Good Friday. We're going to have Good Friday there, and we will have a loss. But we will have Easter. We will have new life. We will have new hope. And so it's actually that will be our last Sunday in the building, will be Easter Sunday. And then we will process at the end of the service over to our new home. And then we'll turn the keys over May 1. And we're going to all be good. We're going to all make a difference. And frankly, I'm happy that this far along in my career, I get to say I helped change the world.
Hmm. Reverend Smith is Senior Minister of the United Congregational Church in Bridgeport. Muhammad, I'll let you have the final word. You know, what does this partnership mean to you in this particular moment?
It's a different phase for us. So now, not only that, we're going to have a beautiful building that is going to be a better fit for our community, but we are going to be real partners on real charity work. I mean, how do you rate your outreach programs?
We're the best there is.
Absolutely.
We're a 5-star food pantry, a domestic violence food pantry.
It's
we have a soup kitchen, our shelter.
Program that everybody should be part of, regardless of religion. When it comes to helping the poor or helping your neighbors, religion is not involved. I remember back in 2010, when there was an earthquake in Haiti, mm-hmm. we did the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center partnered with the University of Bridgeport and the Muslim Association, Muslim Student Associations at the University of Bridgeport, and we did an interfaith fundraising for
the earthquake in Haiti,
victims. Mm-hmm. And we had a charity, a Muslim charity organization, a Jewish charity organization, and a Christian charity organization. That's the way it's supposed to work,
That's
we all come together as humans to help whoever in need and put religion aside.
Reverend Smith,
we're going to be having to go to break now. But it was so great to talk with you. Again, Muhammad Hamada is community board member of the Bridgeport Islamic Community Center, and Reverend Sarah Smith, senior minister at the United Congregational Church in Bridgeport. Now, coming up, we continue an occasional series on Where We Live, where we profile immigrants living in Connecticut. After the break, we'll meet Polish native Roman Nowak. Stay with us. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. We have an occasional series on the show that highlights the stories of immigrants living in Connecticut. They come from many different backgrounds. They're white-collar or blue-collar workers. They're artists or students. Roman Nowak is one of those immigrants. He was born in war-torn Poland, but he's lived in Connecticut for a long time now. The New Britain resident is a business owner, a philanthropist, and a community leader. Roman joins us now to tell us more about his journey to the United States. Roman, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm being glad to be here.
So tell us about your childhood in Poland.
Well, I tell you, it was hard for me. I lost my father when I was 10 years old. So my mom had six kids, and I have to struggle with when I was young.
And so you were living in Poland at a time where it was under Soviet control?
That's correct.
Tell us about that.
I wasn't involved directly with the communists, so... But I was a hard living over there, you know. It's like, not like here, you know. It's, I don't have a car. There was a dream in Poland to have a car that time, you know. So the communists was a hard way to, mm-hmm. and they control everything. Let's put it this way. So it's not that easy, you know.
And this was a country torn by war. You were born in 1945. Tell us about that impact.
An end of the war. You know, that's what it is. I don't remember anything from war, of course. But my mom taught me a lot about it, and my father even have some friends that say, you know, my father was name is Joseph. You know, don't stick a nose anywhere, and you can go through the war. Mm-hmm. You know, if you get interesting about a lot of stuff, then you've been in trouble.
So I understand in seventh grade you left school to work as a laborer. What was that like to leave school?
Well, I leave home and to go to look for work because, like I said, my mom has, you know, six kids, and then I'm glad they, you know, I have a mother like that, you know, but... Of course, in Poland, it was hard to work and make some extra money. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You eventually married and had three daughters, but you're talking about, you know, just finding work. It was difficult. So that led you to leave Warsaw, and you ended up in a country that many of us know about these days, and that's Iraq. Tell us about that journey.
Well, Iraq was the first, of course, first time I ever go out of Poland. I was going to Iraq, and that was that was a big surprise. But Iraq wasn't that much different of Poland. We were working in a desert, and I see the all Iraqis, the poor that was working for my team over there, you know. And that was kind of you find a different way to live. Mm-hmm.
And so you were working for a Polish-based construction company, Mosul.
That's correct. In Mosul, about 25 miles off northeast of Mosul, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're in a desert, it's hot, you must miss your family.
Yeah, at some point we work at night, can't work during the day. It was like 110, 120 degrees, you know. But I miss my family, that's correct.
And how long were you there?
I was in Iraq for one year, then went to Poland for vacation for like 2 weeks, and after 2 weeks, I go back, and after a few months, I decide to do something different.
And what did you decide?
I decide to look for other country. I dream of America. My dream was come here. So I left Iraq. I went to Kuwait, and I went to a U.S. Consul in Kuwait. And then they tell me, you know, we can help you here. You have to go to Beirut, to Lebanon. Mm-hmm. So I went to Lebanon, go to embassy. So they also directly, I was thinking that, you know, you go to embassy, hey, here's the visa, go to U.S. But they tell me you got to wait 1 year to get to U.S. if you get, permission to go there, of course, yeah.
So you took a big risk because, you know, you're trying to escape Soviet rule. You're in Iraq working for a Polish-based company. And now you're trying to seek asylum to come to the U.S. I mean, when you were told that you had to wait, what did you do?
Well, at some point I was kind of, you know, thinking about to go back to Poland because, you know, I got three kids there, you know. That youngest daughter was 9 months old when I left. Mm-hmm. So... But I have some friends in Lebanon, and they help me a lot. They are the people with a big heart. They give me room. They give me food because I have no work, okay, no money, and they provide that for me for 1 year. And that was big help for me. And that was, of course, inspiration. I said, go to U.S. Don't worry. Don't give up. So finally, 1 year exactly, I come to U.S. Mm-hmm. 1973, at 23rd of May.
You remember that day vividly?
I remember that day. Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Did you fly into JFK?
I fly to JFK, and like I say, I stay overnight, one night in New York City. I wake up in the morning, everybody speak English. Oh, my gosh, you know. Of course, in Beirut, I didn't waste my time for 1 year. I went to U.S., the University, America University in Beirut. Mm-hmm. to learn English, a little bit of English.
Tell me what would have happened if that visa had not come through and you were in Lebanon. What would have happened to you?
Well, I guess you got to take some other choice. I was thinking also go to Australia. So, you know, you have some, but the probably going to take more time, you know.
You risked prison if you had been found out.
Of course, yeah, of course. At least till the communists fall down, you know.
And how did you communicate with your wife about your plans?
Well, I send the letters to Poland, and of course, I even send the letters with a different name, so they want to check the letters, whatever I talk about, you know.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. I'm speaking with Roman Novak. He's a New Britain resident. He's an immigrant from Poland. He's lived here for a long time, and we're learning about Roman's story as part of an occasional series that we have on the show about the stories of immigrants who've come to this country, who've settled here in Connecticut. Now, Roman, you told me you received political asylum in 1973, and you remember that day, again, May 23rd, when you flew into JFK. What plans did you make? How did you know where to go?
Well, yeah, I'm hoping somebody had, when you come to New York City, there was that time was plenty of work in the U.S., I guess, and we had gentleman from Newington factory, the Atlantic machine. He was in New York, and he was watching who comes to New York, and he told me, if you want to go for work to Connecticut. I says, of course, I want to go. I want to work. So next day, we just come to Berlin by train and start working in Newington factory.
So it sounds like by luck, you found a job.
Yeah, by luck, yes. And every day, and I work every day, so.
A lot of hard work.
Never miss work.
So you were working in Newington for this company, Atlantic Machine.
Yeah.
But where were you living?
I live for a couple months. I have some long cousin in Newington. That's why when we come from New York, and I tell the guys, you know, oh, Newington, I have the cousin in Newington. Oh, you got to work there. So he's right away, when we come to New Britain, he called them. Hey, your cousin is here, but you come to work. So they take me for a couple months. And then I moved to New Britain and go on my own.
Now, at the time that you moved to New Britain, was that a place where lots of Polish immigrants were living?
Oh, that was New Britain is fascinating with the Polish people because, you know, you have New Britain Stanley Work, Pfaffner Bearing Company. That was like almost 30,000 people working. Those two factories. So it's all Polish people, a lot of Polish clubs, and anywhere you go.
That must have helped you because while you were waiting to be reunited with your family, there were people that knew about what Poland was like, its culture, its food, its customs. Did that help you?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it helped very much, you know. When you come, you come to the United States, it's like a free person, right? You feel like, wow. But I was dreaming about bring my kids. Mm-hmm. So my dream come true in 1976. So soon I get the green card. I send the paper or application to Poland for my wife to come to, with the kids come to U.S. Yeah.
What was that like when you saw them?
Oh, that was, man, I can't imagine, you know, I can't even explain, you know, what's go through my mind that time. I meet them with my youngest daughter. She was 9 months old when I left. So she came here, was six years old. Mm. Yeah.
So you missed a few years of her growing up, but then there she is standing before you.
So now I see my grandkids growing up. So.
Yeah. So you went on and opened up your own business. I see co-founder and co-owner of Focus Technology in Berlin,
yeah,
a company that manufactures parts for the defense industry. So looking back at your life, I mean, it appears you have achieved the American dream.
It is, yeah. I'm very happy, and I won't change the country for never, you know. So that's why I'm happy. Soon I get the 5 years be a permanent resident, I just get this, you know, the citizenship right away.
And what about your daughters? How did they do acclimating to Connecticut after living in Poland all that time?
Well, they come, and they, of course, it's a hard time to, you know, you come at a new language. They never they never learned English in Poland, but they come in June. I put them right away to summer school to learn some English before they start the year of school. You know? And they do very good.
I understand they all went to Ivy League schools.
Yeah, yes.
So you must be very happy to see that your children have grown up and are doing well.
I'm very happy.
You know, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you understand personally what it means to leave a country because of persecution. You risked a lot in your path, your journey from Poland all the way to Connecticut. You know, today there's conversations surrounding refugees and asylees, and it's become very politicized. You know, what would you tell people who may not understand that what it's like for people who have no choice but to leave their homeland so that they can have a better life for themselves, for their families?
Well, if this is the case, you have to push yourself. You know, not everybody have the of course they have the, you know, ability to do that, because some people are scared. I don't want to go nowhere. You know, I want to be here. It's nothing. It's not common by itself. You have to work for it. So go for it, because if you think you can make it better for your family and yourself, this is way, and this is a country to be.
I'm sure you've heard the, you know, there's some comments in this country that, you know, they don't understand the immigrant experience. They don't understand what it's like to leave everything they know and come here. What would you tell them, to Americans who are very lucky and maybe have grown up in a particular part of the country, you know, maybe have never had to sacrifice like that? What would you tell them?
It's the best country in the world we are living in. So you have to, everybody have to understand they come here, and plenty of work, you know.
So you came here again, you opened up a business, your children are doing well. I understand that you're also giving back to your community. Tell me about that.
That's why I'm very involved with the Polish American Council, where we once a year we organize big event in New Britain. They call the Polish Harvest Festival, and I do this for 20 years now, and every profit we make on this, we give it to the people who need the most. We give it to other people, non-profit organizations like Polish Saturday School, we give it to Polish Scouts, we give it to whatever who need help, not only Polish ethnic, anybody. I tell you one story when the few months back with one lady, she from Puerto Rico, she dropped a newspaper in the morning for me, for my house, and she left me the flyer. She lost the apartment and everything. She got an apartment by fire. She need help. So I go back right away to my friends and the organization. I asked, well, we got to give her some money, okay? So we end up giving her $200, and I pull from my pocket another $200 and give it to her. So we don't look who they are. They need help. We help. That's what we are.
Roman Nowak is a Polish immigrant, a business owner, a philanthropist. He's also a 2016 inductee into the Immigrant Heritage Hall of Fame, which honors immigrants living here in Connecticut. Roman, it was so nice to talk with you and hear your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to be here, and thank you for having me here.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. WNPR's executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Check out wmpr.org/where we live for more about the show. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.